Welcome to Case in Point, produced by the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School. My name is Matt Marin, and I'm the Multimedia Coordinator from the Communications Department. Today, my guest is Practice Professor of Law, Cynthia Dahl, who is the Director of the Detkin Intellectual Property and Technology Legal Clinic, to discuss the clinic's operations during the coronavirus pandemic. Thank you for joining us. So could you talk a little bit about what the Detkin Intellectual Property and Technology Legal Clinic is?
It's a course that we offer at Penn Law, but it's a special course in that we call it a teaching law firm. And it allows students to learn about cutting-edge issues in IP and technology through doing actual client work, direct service client work.
Great. And could you maybe talk a little bit about who your clients are, either specific companies that you've helped or just kind of broadly who you're helping and in what capacity?
So our clients range from individual inventors or early stage startup companies to artists, nonprofits, and then we do a substantial amount of work also for sophisticated spin-offs that are trying to commercialize the pen-invented technologies.
What are the pen-invented technologies? Could you talk a little bit about those and how the clinic plays a role in that world?
So these are pretty sophisticated technologies that, again, are sort of on range, but some examples, we've represented startups that are in cancer treatment space. We've got machines that are better able to dose drugs. We've got they're generally in the medical space and pretty sophisticated. And these startups are looking to basically commercialize the cutting edge inventions that are coming out of Penn Labs. And the kind of work that we do for them is we help them to identify a market space and look at the patents of the companies that are already in that space and help them to figure out how their cutting edge technology can be rolled out without infringing other people's patents. Or we help them to figure out whether or not we are effectively protecting all aspects of that early stage technology. And if we're not, where patents could be filed.
All right. So how does the clinic provide a cutting edge experience for a student's legal training in the areas of intellectual property and technology?
Having a clinic that's a transactional IP clinic is in itself a little bit cutting edge because these sorts of clinics are not that common across the country. Most of these clinics have been started in the last 5 years or the last 10 years at the most. And so that in itself is a unique experience. Also though, taking an IP transactional clinic exposes students to very cutting edge technologies, just in the substance of what our clients are trying to do. And in turn, in working with these cutting edge technologies, it raises really novel legal questions that we constantly have to grapple with. So that's a lot of fun and helps the students to sort of stay on the cutting edge of law. And then finally, through the clinic, I'm trying to expose the students to skills that they're going to need to develop to practice at the cutting edge. And the first skill that I really work hard to have the students develop is working across disciplines with engineers, for example, business school students, design students, medical school students, nursing school students, because these are the people that are going to be their future clients. And I also try to give them exposure to some technology tools that will make their practice more efficient, because I really feel like more and more lawyers are going to be using these sorts of tools.
Do you want to talk a bit about how the technology that you're using in your clinic is pushing forward the profession and preparing your students to be even further prepared for entering the real world?
So look, there are a lot of great tech tools out there that are helping lawyers to be more efficient and do better work for their clients. We have been lucky enough to get some free subscriptions to a couple of them so that the students can get some exposure before they start to practice. One tool that we use quite heavily is called Enography. It's a really powerful patent search and analysis tool that really crosses the boundaries between law and business. We also have been using a great trademark scheduling tool called AppCall. And we've also taken advantage of a couple of programs that allow lawyers to think in a tech-savvy way. One competition that we sponsored two teams for this year, and this is technically outside of the clinic, but this is a program that I also oversee, was called Iron Tech. It's sponsored by Georgetown, and it challenges lawyers to come up with and develop tech tools that help solve problems of access to justice. And so we sponsored two teams who did well and really enjoyed the experience.
I got a question. So what makes a good, or rather great, IP lawyer?
Ah, that's a great question. I think flexibility and openness makes a good IP lawyer. Of course, all the other things that make great lawyers, like attention to detail and preparedness and staying on top of areas of the law, also important. But I think as to sort of the openness, I think this is an area of the law that changes constantly. You have to work with a lot of people. You can't get the job done yourself. And so I think that you just have to be able to really listen, be curious, be open, and be nimble, because our area of the law calls upon you to be flexible and constantly learning, which is actually what I think is the best part of this area.
Great, thank you. All right, so speaking of being nimble, yet again, we're in the middle of a pandemic. I've probably said that in every episode I've recorded over the past few weeks. You know, so we were on spring break. So you had a clinic in session, or it was on break, right?
Yeah.
So could you talk a little bit about how this maybe changed your plans and kind of what transpired over the semester?
Well, plans went out the window. So changing plans, I don't know. Well, okay. So like every other course, we had to think about the logistics of delivering material and helping students to learn. And so, of course, the seminar went completely online and all their supervisory sessions, completely remote as well. I meet with the students several times a week, not only in seminars, but also to oversee their client work. So all of those meetings had to go online. And so I think we lost a little bit. I fear that we lost a little bit of the bonding that we can usually do in a small class, because we were constantly having to talk online. But besides the logistics, we also had to think about how to continue to deliver the client service, because that's really the heart of the clinic experience. Luckily, most of our clients were pretty tech savvy, and they had computers and the internet available to them. And so we were able to shift probably more easily in my clinic than in several other clinics to a total online delivery of client services. And then, of course, the client's circumstances changed, which was probably the most disruptive pivot for us. There were certain clients that immediately lost their funding, for example. Clients that were banking on being able to roll out content for summer camps, for example, completely, that was disrupted. But for every client that sort of had to scale back, we also had clients that really had to quickly ramp up. We have a client that delivers a lot of services online and thought that this was an ideal time to pivot to put out even more services. And so all of a sudden they leaned on us with additional legal questions and really quick deadlines. Had another client that actually is specializing in a technology that has sterilization capabilities. And all of a sudden they were being contacted by, government agencies to really ramp up their technology so that they could sterilize, for example, hospital rooms where somebody had been infected with COVID. And so all of a sudden, for every client that had to scale back, we had clients that had to ramp up. And every one of them had to consider what it was going to be like to do business in their area with a pandemic going on.
I mean, just given that experience, what did that give to students, or how did you see them respond?
The students were amazing. First of all, I think the students are always they always realize that once they take a clinic that they're working with real clients that are really depending on them. And so by and large, all of our students really respond to that and try to give their best effort to the clients. But I think also once the pandemic hit, I think most of us were looking for ways to help. Such crazy circumstances that you really try to help. You're grateful for what you have, and you try to reach out to those that are, you know, in worse off scenarios than you're in. And I think also because all of us were kind of cooped up, and a lot of the distractions, like the happy distractions of our lives, sort of fell away, we could really focus on what we were responsible for delivering. And so I think the students were amazing and really stepped it up. And as the clients had additional questions, you know, they really put more time into the clinic, I think, this semester than ever before. I had one student who actually, even when we went to credit fail, right? So she had no incentive to do this. She volunteered to do open office hours through the free library, knowing that it wasn't going to affect her grade at all, just because she knew that somebody could really benefit from her expertise.
What's and open so office she, hours? I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry. We partner with the Business Resource and Innovation Center at the Free Library of Philadelphia twice a semester to offer office hours to early stage entrepreneurs and individuals that have intellectual property questions. And so we were able to do the first such session this semester, but then the pandemic hit and our second session was scheduled to happen after the school closed. And so I reached out to the students and I said, you haven't had this experience, you know, that the other half of the class has had. Would you like to do it anyway? And I had one student that was really enthusiastic about doing it, even though, as I said before, we'd gone to credit fail and there was really no pressure on her to do it.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. So I think that just sort of speaks to the drive that these students have, the sense of responsibility that they have to their clients and to the community.
So, and then what did you kind of find were the difficulties of continuing the clinic during the pandemic?
You know, when you work with a startup community, entrepreneurs, there are always pivots and shifts and changes and surprises. And that's what's fun with working with this community. And I think is a great learning experience for students who are interested in business, because they really need to check in with their clients and make sure that they're a trusted counselor, or else they end up doing work that ends up being unnecessary, or, you know, when the client has pivoted anyway. So I think that this particular crisis put all of that usual learning on overload. We had that pivot just exponentially revealed. And so it was a difficult, sure. Was it, I think, just an emphasis on tendencies that we see anyway with our clients? Sure. I think that all of the clients were in dire circumstances and all had to pivot, and then we got taken along for the ride. So that was hard, but I thought a great learning experience for me, for the students, and not that much different from what they have to experience when they work with this community anyway. There are always changes and pivots and crises and challenges.
For sure. And maybe what are some of those solutions that you've discovered over this time period that maybe you've never experienced in your legal career up to this point?
With solutions. Gosh, I think if we had solutions, we'd all be better off. I think compensation.
Or rather, band-aids.
band-aids. So I think over communicating, that's probably not the right way to put it, but increased communication has been really critical. And that's with the students, with our administration, you know, just in how what the expectations were with the school, with our clients, just keeping up, because things were changing so quickly. You really needed to keep up with each other, with clients, in order to deliver good service. And so I always knew that, But I think this particular situation has really emphasized the importance of rapid, constant, clear communication.
Great. Thank you very much. That's great. I feel like, just a side observation, and about open communication, I mean, it's kind of like one of these moments where you really do have to face your fears and assume that role of being a very assertive person and an assertive attorney. You know what I mean? Because, you know, I'm not saying like you or I necessarily, but I'm sure there are law students who have certain anxiety and can kind of hide at certain points. But now it's like, can't do that. You got to really put your best foot forward and do your best to communicate with everyone around you to make sure things are getting done.
100%. I think that that is something that the clinic forces the students to face even in a non-pandemic semester. Because the students are first chairs on these cases, and I don't reach out to the clients. I tell them in the beginning of the semester, these clients are your clients. I'm here to support you. I'm here to answer questions. And if you really get stuck, I might suggest that you check out certain things. But these clients are your clients, and you need to communicate with them. And so I think that going through the clinic helps them to realize that if you don't communicate, you really can't deliver counsel that the clients can act on. Mm-hmm. And your counsel is, it may be gold plated, it may be 100% correct, but if your client doesn't hear it, they're not going to implement your advice. They're not going to understand your advice. And so you have to communicate well. And I think that this particular semester, that message was only emphasized. I asked that the students reach out to their clients right after we closed to have that conversation with them about their pivot. Or whether they were going to continue along business as normal. And I think the students were really surprised with what the clients came back with and were universally really glad that they took that initiative to reach out. The clients weren't going to reach out to the students. They weren't going to say, hey, you know, stop doing what you're working on, because the clients were not even thinking about that. They were just thinking about paying people, staying afloat. What was the market going to look like in 2 weeks? And so if the students hadn't taken the initiative to reach out, I think they would have been left behind. And I think that was a good message for all of us.
Yeah, that's a great message for all who find this podcast somewhere out there. So what's the status of the clinic this summer? Do you have students working over the summer? Are you gearing up for other projects? Kind of what does the summer look like for the Deccan clinic?
Because we're a transactional clinic, we can scope by and large the representation to end by the end of the semester. And so generally what I end up doing most summers is some of the hangover work that is left, but generally we've closed out most of what we've promised to close out, all of what we've promised. But there are still some questions sometimes that remain. So I've hired an RA to help with some projects, but most of the clinic students won't be doing client work over the summer. What I'm focusing on is thinking ahead to the fall. If we have to have a remote clinic again, a virtual clinic again, where I'm teaching over Zoom, how can I make that the most effective clinic experience that I can for the students and for the clients? And so I'm using a student RA this summer to help me think through how to make that learning experience more effective online. And I'm also thinking about developing some virtual tools for entrepreneurs who have a lot of IP questions. We are going to take the time over the summer to think about whether or not we can develop a technology tool to help them to file applications on their own and figure out whether or not they need trademark applications, or if we're going to be delivering content virtually, either like in a seminar style or in some kind of a static asynchronous learning. So I'm going to work with the RA on developing some technology content for entrepreneurs, especially in the trademark space. And third, I've been thinking a lot about the interplay between privacy law and contact tracing applications that are becoming increasingly popular is not the right word, but I guess more people are looking towards implementing some kind of a contact tracing application to help with the pandemic response and get us back to more of a normal operation. And so I've been thinking a lot about those issues and starting to work with people across the university as well as across clinics through different schools to comment on some of those issues and hopefully provide us with some answers.
Oh, that sounds very interesting. Do you have any idea what form that would take? I mean, is that like research? Is that some sort of app, or what would that kind of look like?
Well, so far it's been research. As you can imagine, there's already a tremendous amount of knowledge out there. Interdisciplinary knowledge, coming back to that theme we were talking about before, people from the medical school are talking to people from the engineering school are talking to people from the law school, you know, about what kinds of contact tracing apps are helpful, permissible, possible. And so it's actually great because it really lands on that theme of different professionals working together to come up with more robust solutions. So far, it's been some research, but I think it could take the form of guidelines, papers. I'm interested in looking at whether or not we can affect some legislation in the space on this, because I think that ultimately, wouldn't it be great to actually have some cohesive guidelines that can guide institutions and states on this interplay between privacy and efficacy.
Just to this point, like in your research, I'm not sure how far along are you. I mean, just considering conversations with colleagues, do you maybe have off the top of your head, like maybe one idea or one example that's like, all right, so this is like a great model for the beginning of contact tracing, and then maybe this was a failed model?
It's too early to really answer that question on failed or good, because what we can see is that the apps that have been rolled out have not had great uptake. And partly that's because of how they were rolled out. Partly it's because of some privacy concerns. But we have models around the world about what different governments are trying. And we have some beginning apps here in the United States that are on one end or the other end of the spectrum. Public health, people are saying that just sort of general notification apps are not going to go far enough to help us to actually quickly notify the right people about potential exposure and also help the public health organizations, governmental organizations, to get good aggregated data about where outbreaks are happening and how to sort of stop future outbreaks. But a lot of people on the other end are saying that the Apple Google solution that is truly a voluntary notification app is really the way to go and as far as we can go if we prize our civil liberties. I imagine that we're going to get some solution that's somewhere in the middle. But right now, really, people are still just talking about what the ideal solution might look like. And a paper that I was just reading this morning was saying that there may not be one ideal solution for all Americans because of differences in infection rates in urban and rural environments. And, you know, some places might not need as robust contact tracing as other places might. And so it may end up being many solutions that are ideal for the whole country. And really, we're just at the beginning of trying to develop again, those answers of apps that are both, that are legally compliant, technologically possible, and also really efficacious for contact tracers, you know, in the medical field.
Yeah, well, that sounds really interesting. Thank you for sharing that. Is there anything that I haven't asked you or any burning thoughts that you want to throw out there to the world?
You know that Chinese curse, it's something like, may you live in interesting times. I can't help but think that this interesting time is going to hopefully cause a lot of really interesting innovation, a lot of creative effort through the arts, a lot of, help us to confront a lot of really interesting questions that we were already starting to confront between privacy and technology. Maybe it will just accelerate the pace that that all of these questions sort of come to the forefront. I just feel like every morning I get up, I'm drinking from a fire hose. There's just so much to learn, and it's so necessary to make decisions. It just seems the urgency has gone up at the same time that the information has gone up. And it's just all that we can do, I think, to just maintain focus, keep afloat, and try to handle all of the different challenges that are coming at us, whether that be teaching challenges, technology challenges, client challenges, and helping to solve sort of these larger societal questions that are really, really important. So if I have any words of advice, I would teach us, like, keep doing, keep on, keep trying. I think it's a really interesting time to be practicing law.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining me today and the rest of the Case in Point fans, coast to coast, continent to continent. Best of luck and stay safe.
Thank you. You too.